Blog Talk Radio. Listening to the Words on Flick show on eWater Radio, KEWRDB. Welcome and good evening. It's Thursday, May 16th, 2019, and you're listening to the Words on Flick show, movie talk from a fan perspective with me, entertainment journalist, blogger, and big movie fan Janine Coveney. I'm also an old school movie fan, as I'm sure you can tell by the theme music and by my topic this evening. Tonight, I'll be sharing first my thoughts on the recent film Bolden, the screen portrait of Buddy Bolden, the unsung father of jazz from early 20th century New Orleans. And then I'll be talking about the major film musicals from the Rodgers and Hammerstein collection. And how do these films hold up? How has what we know now of history and our better understanding of culture, has all of this robbed these musicals of their magic? Are they a product of their time, or are they enduring? I know they really formed my opinion of what screen musicals could be, and they were very, very very influential to me as a young child and as a fan of movies. So stay tuned, and we'll start talking about Bolden. Okay, that was a snippet of a tune called Shake It High, performed by Wynton Marsalis for the film Bolden, which was released in theaters earlier this month. And I wanted to spend a few minutes on it because it's so seldom that there's an attempt to delve into or document really the roots of jazz on the big screen in a fictional way that is not a strict documentary. Particularly a film about New Orleans, which was such a unique place and is still a unique place in the culture of this country because of its being an intense melting pot of races, languages, sort of the laissez-le bon temps rouler lifestyle, behaviors. It was a place where many free people of color gathered before slavery was officially ended in this country. And this film looks at the life, imagines the life of Charles Joseph Buddy Bolden, who was a cornet player at the turn of the 19th century. And his style of syncopated, brassy, in-your-face playing took the Americana and ragtime of the period and evolved it into what became jazz music as we know it today. And the film was a labor of love for director Daniel Pritzker. And I see that he graduated in my same graduation year in the same town, Boston. Can you imagine? We were in Boston at the same time. He graduated from Tufts University, and he actually earned a Juris Doctor from Northwestern University Law School in 1986. And this guy is a big deal. He and his wife are trustees of the J. Pritzker Foundation, which created the Pritzker Challenge at Tufts University with gifts of $10 million. And it's established to encourage members of the Tufts community to establish endowed or term scholarships for underprivileged minority students. So that's a laudable project, right? He's also a musician, Pritzker. He was the founder, guitarist, and songwriter for the band Sonia Dada out of Chicago. And yeah, this is information that I'm taking off the internet because I didn't really know who Pritzker was. Like, who is this guy who has all of this time and money to make a film about a jazz icon in the jazz community that still people don't know a lot about and there isn't a lot of information about. In fact, Pritzker was rated in 2013 as one of the 400 richest Americans by Forbes. So you can imagine. So he spent 20 years apparently working on this film about Buddy Bolden, and it did open around the country this month, May. I actually saw it a couple of weeks ago, finally. I know some other people who are fortunate to live in the big cities of New York and Los Angeles probably got to see it a lot earlier. And it was also a topic that was brought up on one of my previous shows talking about jazz on film. We were looking forward to seeing this movie. So I saw it. What did I think of it? What is the words on Flick's official view? It's a beautiful film. You know, I fear that its impact is going to be lost, though. And I think that's partially for a couple of reasons. So let me talk about the film itself, and then I'll come back to why I think its impact was probably a little bit muffled. So this is a very impressionistic, artistic type of film that is not a strict biography. It's more inspired by what we know of Bolden's life or what Pritzker was able to uncover about Bolden's life. There are so few written documents and no surviving recordings of Bolden's work to this day. And yet, Buddy Bolden was frequently cited by other jazz greats as the father or the king of New Orleans jazz. So as a film, it is really beautiful to look at. And really, that's part of the film-going experience is a visual medium. We want to see visual storytelling, but we also, at least I do, I want to see pretty pictures. And I think that in showing pretty pictures, we get to see what New Orleans probably looked like at the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, and we're able to get an impression of being plunked down in that world. So many modern films are very quick. They have quick cuts. You know, you're looking at things, a stream of images in a short period of time. And that kind of reflects our current lifestyle when we have so many different distractions, technology, life is very fast-paced. At that time, life was a lot slower, and I think Pritzker does a great job in giving us a sense of the flow of that time. It's also, you know, he recreates the clothing, the way buildings look, the way New Orleans looked. And while the film is in color, a lot of the scenes are sort of saturated to resemble sepia tone or old-timey photographs, and that really does make a difference in it. And while African Americans had been emancipated from slavery for more than a century, But at this time in the movie, African Americans are free, they're surviving, but you do see the long-reaching effects of segregation, poverty, crime, drug abuse in the film. You have African Americans who are being accepted into society, but only on certain terms, okay? So the story of Buddy Bolden is both new and kind of depressingly familiar because it's a story about an artistic genius who rises seemingly from nothing to acclaim and respect only to suffer due to insecurity, racial inequality. He's being preyed on by others looking to make a buck. He starts to become paranoid about others stealing his creativity, which is actually a really very real fear. And his own ignorance of the bigger picture and what the music industry can offer him with the invention of the gramophone and the recording process. So many artists born to make great art are not necessarily great businessmen. We've seen that. And not all of them have the discipline or self-control to withstand the downs in their careers along with the ups. So Bolden is a star among African Americans, but when he attempts to step outside of that box, he's brutally smacked down. So let me just spend a few words on the star who plays Bolden, who is Gary Carr, who I did not realize was English born. He's apparently British. Who knew? He does the best that he can with that role, considering that he had to build it from the ground up because there's no, as I mentioned, no existing documents. There's no film. There's no interviews with Buddy Bolden. And even in the first part of the film, he doesn't even speak. But we feel his pain as a man who rose to fame but fell due to his own personal demons and the limitations of the times. And Carr is wonderful to look at. This is only the second project I'd ever seen him in. I first saw him in HBO's grimy series, The Deuce, playing a small-time pimp in the 1970s. And he's got a mix of swagger, brutality, and then there's like sensitivity under all of that. And that was just riveting in that project because he's dangerously attractive and frighteningly manipulative. You know, he's a pimp. But in the end, he's just human. So in Bolden, Carr has to portray this real-life figure. And as I said, somebody who's very talented and a talented musician. And he, I don't know if he plays the cornet, but he sure looked like he could play. So at the beginning of the movie, Bolden is already institutionalized. He's in a mental facility for what was termed alcoholic psychosis. He did have an alcohol problem, and you see in the movie his descent into madness, basically. He overhears, while he's in the institution at the beginning of the movie, he overhears a radio playing a live show by Louis Armstrong, in which Armstrong credits Bolden as the king of New Orleans jazz. And so from that point, the film goes on with a series of flashbacks that take him from a young boy who heard distinct musical patterns in the rhythms of the sewing machines at the sweatshop where his mother worked, to how he and a group of his local friends formed a band that soon became super popular for their fiery good time fare. And in fact, the little club where they played, people started calling it the Funky Butt. So Bolden literally had ladies melting in their pants, you know, dancing and grooving, and he was a true rock star of that era. So Bolden's music attracts the attention of a local hustler named Bartley, who becomes the band's manager, and he's played by Eric Leray Harvey, who seems at home here after donning similar garb. I think he was in HBO's Boardwalk Empire. Anyway, the actor actually called his character a mix between P.T. Barnum and Don King at the time. So he pushes Bolden to get more attention and bigger gigs, but he also exposes him to that lifestyle rife with the temptations of alcohol, women, drugs. And in the end, Bartley has to kowtow to the white string pullers, you know, who control Bolden and block him from a recording legacy. So while it's enlightening to learn about this artist, you know, it's sort of disheartening because it's another in a long line of stories about genius cut short, particularly African-American genius. And it's a universal story of the push and pull between art and commerce and also between genius and insanity. So Yahya DaCosta plays Bolden's wife, and she's pretty good. as I said, the film is beautifully shot and edited. There are gorgeous set pieces, as when Bartley shoves Bolden out of a weather balloon. Like, he's literally, like, in a balloon in the air, and Bartley has him sort of parachute down into this stately garden party playing his cornet. And he joins his band on the ground and basically takes over the tea party. And then we get to see Bolden on the bandstand and the excitement of his style of play and how he leads the band and how he just rivets and excites people in that era. And I thought Pritzker, as a director, was really, really good at creating that excitement and really letting us, as the audience, hear that music. Now, the music was provided and recreated by Wynton Marsalis, who has to be one of New Orleans' favorite musical sons, and New Orleans seems to be the birthplace of so many great brass players, and particularly trumpet players. It's a tradition coming out of the bands there, and so I salute Wynton for that. The music is stellar. So Buddy Bolden was born in 1877. He became popular around 1900, and he played until around 1907, until circumstance kind of brought him down. So this film is really an artistic triumph, but because it's such a sad story, I don't think it's going to make Buddy Bolden a household name. We'll see when Oscar time rolls around. This film really should get attention for its craft, its level of craftsmanship. But because Buddy Bolden doesn't have a recorded legacy, his music's not going to be rebounding on top of anybody's charts. Not that jazz music is ever at the top of anybody's charts these days. So the most I can say is that maybe Bolden will cast new light on the deepest roots of jazz music in this country. It was America's first true indigenous art form, born in these shores through the creativity of people born here. Enhanced by African rhythms and European melody. Jazz is also a democratic idiom. Yes, the music is written down, but the magic of it is in the improvisation, the ability of each player to use the main melody as a jumping off place to say what they want to say musically and show off their musicianship. And then each instrumentalist usually gets their turn in the spotlight as a solo. So go back and give jazz a listen and seek out Bolden if you can. And that's Bolden for Words on Flicks. Okay, now I want to get to Rodgers and Hammerstein. And here's a tune that you all know.
Where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain. Oh, the home every night, my honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. We know we belong to the land, and the land we belong to is grand. And when we say, hi-yip-hi-oh-yay, we're only saying, you're doing fine, Oklahoma, Oklahoma, okay.
Woo! Okay. So this week's topic is the musicals of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and I picked it, as I said, because I feel like that's sort of the baseline from when I was a child. Certainly musicals had been produced in Hollywood for decades and decades before, but in the late 50s and 1960s, I was a small child in the 1960s, these Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals were big events, and they sort of dominated the landscape because they had been on Broadway. The songs were part of the pop music reality. They were on the radio. You heard the songs everywhere. You know, Rodgers and Hammerstein were, I would dare say, the most popular, most influential musical collaborators of modern times, and their partnership would push the musical form forward in ways that were considered groundbreaking. And a lot of the current musicals rest on that foundation of Rodgers and Hammerstein. Both of them had worked with other collaborators beforehand. Richard Rodgers had previously worked with lyricist Lawrence Hart on several projects. My favorite of theirs is Pal Joey, which was made into a movie with Frank Sinatra, Kim Novak, and Rita Hayworth. Hammerstein had worked with others on operettas and the like, including another favorite, Showboat, with Jerome Kern. So they were the team that really championed the song as a vehicle to push the story forward and for characters to really define themselves. And I think previously, I mean, although some musicals at the time before that had done that, Rodgers and Hammerstein really perfected that. So as I said, these musicals were really wildly popular on Broadway. And again, I'm from New York, so Broadway had a direct influence on radio, on news coverage. You couldn't get away from them. So today's Disney musicals owe a lot to the Rodgers and Hammerstein template, particularly the animated musicals. And while there are more contemporary musical styles that are reverting to the jukebox style of building a story around existing songs and other musicals that play with the song form itself, Rodgers and Hammerstein was sort of it and the bedrock of my youth. So I wanted to spend time with them. And I'll start with Oklahoma because it was the first Rodgers and Hammerstein collaboration. So the film version starred Shirley Jones, Gordon McRae, Rod Steiger, and Gloria Graham. And it plunked me down in a new place. What was it like to live in an American territory out in the West back in the early 1900s, before it was even a state? I don't know. The territory didn't become a state until 1907, the same year Buddy Bolden was blowing jazz in Storyville. So out there in cow and corn country, pioneers had settled the frontier through farming and ranching. As we learn in that musicals, the cowman and the farmer should be friends song. So this song really crystallized a very real conflict going on at the time between farmers who needed fences and, you know, a set still piece of land in which to grow their crops. And ranchers wanted their cattle to have free range to roam and graze, and they didn't like fences on the land. They wanted to be able to drive cattle as they saw fit. This is a very, very real conflict, and I think the conflict actually led to violence and political maneuvering along the western frontier. And I think the movie Open Range, starring Kevin Costner, really delves into that idea more. Anyway, this charming piece of Americana centers on the romances of two couples, primarily good girl Lori and amiable cowboy Curly, whose romance is threatened by a claim from farmhand Judd, played by Rod Steiger, as kind of a lunk. He wants Lori for his own. So this musical includes a dark dream ballet sequence transferred from the stage musical that was considered to be pioneering in its day. Very rarely did stage musicals, song and dance musicals, you know, it was hoofing, it wasn't ballet, you know. So this was new. So anyway, these two characters spend a lot of the musical pretending to others that they don't care for each other, which is kind of funny. The secondary romance in the film is about the character Ado Annie, who is kind of the town, you know, easy girl. She's a party girl. And her cowboy boyfriend, Will Parker, wants to make her settle down. So that's kind of funny. But what I enjoy about that is that she sings this great song called I Can't Say No, you know. Guys are always romancing her, and you know, she's like, if a guy tells you that your skin looks like cream and he's got to have cream and dye and your lips look like cherries and, you know, he just loves you, what are you going to do, spit in his eye? Like, she's like, that's not who I am. I just go with it. And I love that idea because It's an attempt to see sexuality from a woman's perspective, and so often women on screen from those times are portrayed, they have to be pillars of virtue, unsullied, you know, they don't give in to romance any more than a few chaste kisses until they're married. So Oklahoma is also set in Indian country, which is interesting because there is nary a Native American to be seen in this film. And there's also a carpetbagger character with a Muslim name. He's supposed to be a Persian, Ali Hakim. So he's played by Eddie Arnold, who is as American as they come. And so in this film, he's a sort of a cartoon foreigner who only has an accent and likes to weave these narratives about his lovemaking because he's got ladies in every port. But anyway, I love how the lyricist Hammerstein adapts the local accent of that time for the rhyme scheme of the song. So, you know, scared becomes skeered. I'm skeered. Pretty, the word pretty becomes purdy, so it can rhyme with flirty. Can't becomes can't, so it rhymes with faint, you know, and more. And so that kind of adds to the character of this film. And its charm. And Rod Steiger, when I watched this film as a kid, Rod Steiger absolutely terrified me. He's like this giant, dirty, you know, monosyllabic hunk who was going to attack poor Shirley Jones and the dream sequence that she has in which his character actually kills Curly is a dark moment in the film. But there's so many, songs from this that people remember. This Sorry with Fringe on Top. People will say we're in love and Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. It was also the first screen feature to be filmed in the Todd AO 70mm widescreen format. So it's eye-fillingly gorgeous. And, you know, it has to be letterboxed on the TV screen. Otherwise, you're not getting the full impact of it. So as a piece of Americana, it's very enduring. It's still sort of delightful if you overlook the fact that, you know, there's no Indians in Indian country. And it's so enduring that it's back on Broadway. It's back on Broadway right now in a version that I understand has the music stripped down to sort of country banjo and violin kind of band to give it more of that Old West feeling. I'm sure that's interesting. So there you go. Oklahoma, a lovely piece of Americana. Moving on. A little more music for you.
Hello, young lover, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. Be brave, young lover, and follow your star. Be brave and faithful and true. Cling very close to each other. Wings on your heels and to fly down a street in a trance. You fly down a street on the chance that you will meet, and you meet not really by chance. Don't cry, young love, whatever you do. Don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. I've had
from The King and I from 1956, a lovely ballad there. The film stars Yul Brynner in his career-making role, and Deborah Carr, whose character, Anna Leon Owens, sings that song. Now, while Oklahoma was adapted from a book called Green Grow the Lilacs, The King and I was adapted from Margaret Landon's novel, Anna and the King of Siam. And once again, the Rodgers and Hammerstein team create a musical set in a foreign country and just plunk us down. The country is now known as Thailand. At a pivotal point in history, the 1860s, the King of Siam, played by Brynner, decided to hire a British governess to educate his many children to help modernize the country, more like Europeanize. And she ends up educating everyone, most especially the king. Can this be categorized as a white savior movie? Maybe. I think so. It's unusual, though, in the fact that the savior comes in the form of a woman, because the status of women was not particularly high at the time in Thailand or even in England, though there was more respect. And I know everyone knows that Shall We Dance song. It's strongly suggested in the film that the widowed Mrs. Anna and the King of Siam have this silent and unconsummated love affair, and that the big production number Shall We Dance is evidence of their affection. But it's never spoken because it would be cross-cultural, it would be cross-racial, and they didn't go there at that time. They did have a strong relationship, so despite her constant threats to leave his employ because he refuses to give her the house she's contracted to receive, Anna ends up staying and advising the king until his death, and we do see that. And one of the reasons that I picked Hello Young Lovers to play as a song, because as an adult, I now understand that song much better. I just thought it was some schmaltzy little song she was singing, and it is a little bit schmaltzy, but now I understand that she sings it because, you know, her character, she's in a foreign country, she's a widow, she's not there to fall in love with anybody. She's kind of like, that part of my life is over. I'm not desperate for love. I'm satisfied in who I am at this point. I'm here to serve my country and my adopted country. My role is to serve this king. I'm satisfied with that. And I'm not bitter over losing the love that I have. So you kind of see her character in that song. And it, you know, it's very sweet because when you're in love, you identify with all the lovers. You know what they're going through. So anyway, so to get back to the rest of the story, what the musical kind of glosses over and considers quaint is the reality that the King of Siam has multiple wives. It is a male-dominant society, and not only does he have multiple wives, the reality of female slavery exists in that country, and it's expressed in the fate of the concubine Tuptim, who in this screen version is played by Puerto Rican performer Rita Moreno. And her character has been given to the king as a gift, but she doesn't want to marry him. She's in love with another, but she's not free. So at some point in the film, she runs away. And when she's found, she's about to be severely punished. You know, she's about to be whipped. And Anna stops the king from lashing her. Now, in the original book, as well as in the previous non-musical version, Anna and the King of Siam, where Rex Harrison stars as the King of Siam, the slave girl Tuptim is actually killed for escaping. And the film goes on after this incident, and apparently Anna gets over this and accepts it as part of the country's customs, and she continues to advise the king. Now, I know there was a remake, was it the 90s or the 1000s, with Jodie Foster in the role of Anna Leon Owens. I wasn't interested in it. Maybe I should watch it and see how they updated this story, but I can't say that I've seen it. Have you seen it? Is it good? I don't know. But what I loved most about this film is when the ladies and the children of the court put on a Siamese version of Uncle Tom's Cabin for the visiting English dignitaries in the film. So when I was watching this as a kid, this was always my favorite part. First, because it was a showcase of traditional Thai or Siamese dance, music, and theater, which is really beautiful and very highly stylized and heavily costumed. And it's wonderful. And perhaps even more importantly, this was a Siamese interpretation of an anti-American slavery tract performed before a group of the world's number one colonizers and enslavers, the English. And they didn't bat an eye. They just thought it was very, you know, amusing. And they thought it was quaint. And I'm just like, wow, this is really something. Anyway, The King and I is also a film where most of the main roles are not played by Asians. As you know, Yul Brynner is Russian. So there you have it. And my mother particularly loved another song from this called Something Wonderful. And you can look it up on YouTube. I won't play it now. I have other things to play. But it seems to express women's devotion to men, even when the men are being brutes, okay? Like, you know, the song is like, he'll hurt and trouble you, but you have to continue loving him because every once in a while he'll say or do something wonderful. And that song falls into the Rodgers and Hammerstein formula of having a big inspirational anthem sung by an older female character at the end of Act One. So you see this again with Climb Every Mountain and The Sound of Music and You'll Never Walk Alone in Carousel. So I know The King and I is an enduring favorite, and it's not my favorite Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, but I won't turn it off if it comes on, I confess. So, speaking of the big song and carousel, here we go.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high, and don't be afraid of the dark.
Sing that one at a graduation or a recital growing up. That was a big, big thing for a long time, many decades. So this is the big Act Two inspirational song from Carousel from 1956. And okay, let's talk about Carousel, because really, this is the saddest, most miserable, depressing of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. I remember seeing it as a kid on TV, and my mom really seemed to like it. And I'm like, okay, well, if she likes it, I'm going to check it out. And what I really liked about it as a kid was, of course, the carousel theme music, which is very catchy. And what's notable about that is when it was on Broadway, and even you hear it even in the film, most Broadway musicals, before the action even begins, you hear an entire, what do they call it? you know, you hear like the overview of all the songs, an overture of all the songs from the musical. You get it from start to finish, and which is kind of interesting because as the musical goes on, all of the music is now familiar to you. You've already heard it, so you're already predisposed to liking the songs because you've already heard them in the overture. Clever. But for this film, they didn't do that. And in this musical on Broadway, they just play the carousel music, which is interesting. Anyway, I love to see the horses spinning around, and I really liked seeing the ballet sequence that was shot on the beach with the little girl. But, okay, Carousel, I saw this film again after not seeing it for decades, and I was appalled. I was appalled by this musical because it seems to condone the idea of domestic violence as a form of love, which is what a lot of people believe. I don't know. Okay, so it reteams Shirley Jones and Gordon McRae in the lead roles, and of course they look fabulous and they sound good. They're great performers. They're and they have great chemistry together. And the music is lovely and a bit more evolved than Rodgers and Hammerstein's previous work. So there's great songs in it. But look, the main character, Billy Bigelow, try saying that three times fast, he's already dead when this starts. And the way I understand it is in the Broadway version, the audience doesn't know that yet. Like, they see the story from beginning to end. But in the film version, they decided to show us that he's dead so that they're not shocked when he suddenly gets it, you know, before the end of the film. So anyway, he's dead. He was not a nice guy. He's kind of lousy in life. And wherever he's gone to after his death, it has to recount all of his earthly missteps, and then he's given a chance to go back to Earth and do a good deed to redeem himself, okay? So it's already a downer, like he's dead, okay? So the story is set in Maine at the end of the 19th century, and Billy is a carousel barker known to have ladies everywhere the carnival lands, so he's a player. And the older woman who owns the carousel kind of uses him as bait to bring young ladies to the ride. And she's super possessive. And so the film doesn't spell it out, but you get the sense that they're more than just employer and employee. You know, like she's got a hold on him and he's using her and something else is going on. But once he claps his eyes on, you know, young Shirley, the mill worker, her name is Julie, the two of them are done for, and they marry, except Billy has to leave the carousel now because Mrs. Munn, or whatever her name is, she's not having it. And so he's basically an unemployed layabout. So the couple ends up moving in with Julie's cousin, who owns a seaside restaurant where Julie has to work to pay the bills. So isn't that a lovely story already? So meanwhile, Julie's best friend from the mill hooks up with an enterprising fisherman. So that's the contrast. Though this guy smells like fish, he makes plenty of money. He treats his girl like a queen, and they have a brilliant future. By contrast, Julie is struggling to make ends meet. She doesn't know where Billy is half the time. And then it is revealed that he beats her. Ain't that romantic? So, of course, Julie turns up pregnant, so Billy hooks up with this ne'er-do-well friend of his in a scheme to rob the mill owner while a Big Island clam bake is going on. So not only does he get nabbed by the police, he accidentally falls on his knife and gets killed. Boo-hoo. And, you know, the musical isn't over yet, but June is busting out all over, and people are dancing and singing. They've had a wonderful clam bake, and it's all, like, we're supposed to get the sense of life's sour and sweet, right? So Julie is heartbroken that she's lost her, you know, her Billy Bigelow, who is larger than life and handsome and rocked her world and all that. But, you know, she's literally just found him. You know, she's busted through the wall of police and onlookers, like, oh my God, Billy's dead, boo hoo hoo hoo. And then she stands up and basically sings "You'll Never Walk Alone" while she's standing over his dead body. I don't know. I'm probably being too hard-nosed about this. It is a musical. So, of course, the part of this flick, Carousel, that makes me really go, what, is toward the end. So, at this point, he's been dead for a while, and now he's looking down, and Billy sees that his daughter is about 16, about to graduate from high school, and she's deeply unhappy because she's been taunted by the fact that she's a fatherless child, and her father was a, you know, he was a ne'er-do-well. He was a criminal. And so Billy comes back down to earth and becomes visible to his daughter briefly to give her a bit of advice. But in that moment, the girl pulls back from him because, like, he's a stranger. And he slaps her on the arm, on the hand. So when this child tells her mother that this strange man tried to put his hands on her, and she says it didn't feel like a slap, but it felt like a kiss. Okay, so the girl says, Mommy, is it possible? Is that possible? So Julie, who we assume seems to have caught a glimpse of the, you know, apparition of Billy before he disappears, she smiles and she says, yes, it is possible, dear, for someone to hit you hard, and it not hurt at all. No. I'm not, that's crazy. Like, when I saw this again as an adult, I was like, what is this saying to a whole generations of women and young girls who are being abused all the time? But anyway, I guess it was a reflection of the times. And to be honest, even though the Maine scenery and the, you know, they shot it in parts of Maine, and they've got beautiful scenes of people in boats on the water, and then they have that clam bake, and I love lobster, and it looks delicious, I don't really need to see Carousel again too soon. You know, it's just, it's too hard, even though there's some fabulous dancing in it as well. And a lot of the songs in this bittersweet tale of marital violence became popular, including, as I said, June is Busting Out All Over, and If I Loved You, If I Loved You. Anyway, we're going to go from darkness into the light and try to laugh it off.
Why would a fellow want a girl like her? A frail and fluffy beauty. Why can't a fellow ever want to prefer a smiling girl like me? A little bubble with a flimsy kind of charm, and with very little trouble, I could break her little arm. Oh, why would a fellow want a girl like her? So obviously unusual. Why can't a fellow ever want to prefer a usual girl like me?
Why can't a fellow ever want a usual girl like me? This is what I used to say to myself sometimes. I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes on Cinderella. It was not a big screen production. It was a small screen production of Cinderella adapting the famous fairy tale. And it was seen on television first in 1957 with Julie Andrews as Cinderella. As a child in the 60s, I got to see the 1967 version with Leslie Ann Warren as Cinderella and Stuart Damon as the prince. And it had Celeste Holm as the fairy godmother and Ginger Rogers and Walter Pidgeon as the king and queen. And, you know, it's fairly short compared with the other musicals. And it's got some really clever lyrics in it, as demonstrated by the stepsister's lament that I just played. And I love other songs from it, including Do I Love You Because You're Beautiful. I don't know. Sorry, I'm singing. I tend to do that. And the song In My Own Little Corner and Lovely Night, which is, you know, great songs. And Cinderella was redone in 1997 with Whitney Houston as the fairy godmother and Brandy as Cinderella, and just entranced a whole new generation of girls. I saw some recent reviews of the 1997 version, and they felt that it was too cartoony and weird. It's got Bernadette Peters in it, and I'm just going blank, you know, some other folks, contemporary folks, but it didn't really get good reviews. So anyway, I'm going to go quickly into the next, which takes us again to a foreign locale. I'm singing along with Bali High. Sorry, you probably got your ears pierced with that one. South Pacific from 1958 with Mitzi Gaynor, John Carr, Ray Walston, Rosano Brazzi. So this is adapted from a couple of short stories from Tales of the South Pacific by James Michener. So side note, Michener was also the author of a giant-sized novel called Hawaii that was also made into a film, a non-musical with Julie Andrews and Richard Harris, and that I could just talk for half an hour about that, but I won't. So back to South Pacific. The story centers on two characters, a nurse, an American GI nurse during World War II, stationed in the South Seas, who falls in love with a widowed French planter, only to find that her racial prejudice won't allow her to marry a man who's been in a relationship with a native islander. And the other character is a young soldier named Joe, who, despite having a girl back home, is lured into a relationship with a young local beauty played by a young Franz Nguyen, by her mother, played by Juanita Hall. Juanita Hall, again, is actually an African-American who played Asian characters in many Rodgers and Hammerstein projects. So this film is supposed to center on prejudice. It's supposed to send a strong anti-racism message. But I feel like that message gets lost in, you know, there's so much else going on. It's a love triangle. There's a big show within a show. There's some World War II maneuvering toward the end of it. So the don't be racist message gets a little bit muffled. And also the message seems only to extend to Asians. Don't be racist to Asians, because African Americans continued to catch hell stateside. And there are no African American characters. But as I mentioned, Juanita Hall plays an African American. She plays an Asian in this film. So, and also, it's like she's her character, Bloody Mary, it, who sings Valley High to entice Joe to the island, is sort of pimping out her daughter, so her daughter Liat. So I never really understood, you know, was she thinking that her daughter would have a better life and that this that Joe would take her away to America, or was she trying to entice Joe to stay in the Tonkinese Islands? I didn't really get it. And also, this film has some weird green, red, and yellow lenses going over the scenes that kind of make it difficult to watch. Anyway, the two final films that we probably don't really have time to get into are Flower Drum Song and The Sound of Music. So for the sake of time, I'm not going to get into The Sound of Music because everybody loves it. Everybody knows it. They've seen it 1,000 times. It's been on TV every year. There's sing-along, live events, and it's restaged so often. I really want to talk about Flower Drum Song because when I saw it years ago, it was the Crazy Rich Asians of its time. It had a mostly Asian cast. It's set in San Francisco's Chinatown about a well-to-do Chinese-American family and their attempts to keep tradition alive. And when I first saw it, watching Nancy Kwan when I was a kid, she was it. She was hip, happening, and gorgeous. And I felt like I was just enduring the rest of the movie until I saw her perform I Love Being a Girl, which is such a prehistoric relic of a song about what it is to be a woman, or Sweet Sunny Sunday, or the awful, you know, Asian riff Tan Fanny. But she could dance. She had smooth patter. I didn't understand that she was the conniving bitch of this movie. So now that I watch it as an adult, and I just saw it again recently, for me, the movie is all about how heartbreaking Mayoshi Yumeki was as Mei Li, the girl who comes from China as a contracted bride to the eldest son. She's just, you know, her simplicity, her acting, her hands, how she uses her hands. She's a singer. She actually recorded several albums in America. She is just gorgeous in this. But it's the film is definitely a product of its time, being that it focuses on the immigrant story of how the older generation insists on clinging to the ways of the old country, even as their children become completely Americanized. And once again, our African-American friend Juanita Hall shows up playing her brother's, the young son's father's sister. She's like the matriarch of the family. And she's trying to get the son, played by Dreamboat James Shigeta. Juan Ta is his character. She's trying to get him married off. So this has some wonderful music in it, but it also has some awful numbers in it, like the Fan Tan Fanny and Chop Suey, which is a culture class song. But one of the best songs is from a minor character, Helen the Seamstress, who's in love with Juan Ta, and she sings the torch song, Love Look Away. And it's just beautiful, and it leads into one of Rodgers and Hammerstein's infamous dream ballet sequences. So without getting into The Sound of Music, there you have it, my overview of Rodgers and Hammerstein's movie blockbusters. For latter year baby boomers, these are the standards by which other modern musicals are judged, but I think they're showing their age. So much has changed in our cultural politics, in our racial politics, our evolved attitudes about the roles of women and immigrants. So they're a little crusty, but for the most part, I still love them. So thanks for listening to this edition of Words on Flicks. Rest in peace to the great Doris Day. I'm Janine Coveney, and I encourage you to revisit classic films and go to the theater to support films by your favorite independent and emerging filmmakers as well. This weekend, I'm going to see the millennial immigrant cross-cultural romance, The Sun is Also a Star, starring Yara Shahidi and Charles Melton. As always, keep watching and keep watching out.
When anything bothers me and I'm feeling unhappy, I just try and think of nice things.
What kind of things?
Well, let me see. Nice things. Daffodils. Green meadows. Skies full of stars. Raindrops on roses. And whiskers on kittens. Bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens. Brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudels, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with a moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses.